back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Before we jump into our program here, focusing on the 319 people who were murdered in Baltimore City in this last year, remind you that programs like this, the Mark Steiner Show, are brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. It's not just a bank, it's a credit union. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. So we are now going to tackle this very hard and horrid and thorny problem in Baltimore. We're here with David Miller, creator of Dare to Be King, LLC, author of many books, including his latest children's book, The Green Family Farm, and has been deeply active in this work for many, many years. And Daniel Webster's in the studio, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, director of the Johns Hopkins Baltimore Collaborative on Violence Reduction, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Prevention of Youth Violence, and professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Cornelius Wiley Scott III, who is executive director of Mothers of Murdered Sons and Daughters United, Inc. here in Baltimore. Good to have all the three of you with us.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
And the lines are open at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. By email, you can tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do join in on this conversation. Part of it is looking at why, part of it is looking at solutions if they exist in a city like Baltimore, where even though these numbers have been really horribly high this year, 319 plus all the shootings, the numbers have always been too high in Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
whether they're 200 or 300. And they're concentrated in the poorest communities in the city. Murders don't happen in Homeland, or they don't happen in Upper Park Heights. They don't happen in many parts of Northeast Baltimore. They happen on the west side and the east side of town instead of the poorest parts of the city. So, and these, it almost feels for many people like they don't know what to do. It's intractable. Older citizens saying, please bring us more police on the corner because we don't know what to do. Our son editorial today talked about that maybe not enough police is part of the problem of why it's happening. Others saying that, no, we don't need more police. We need to redefine community and change the nature of community. Other people, if you've been saying, Daniel, it's about guns and poverty. So let's talk a bit about what we think are the roots and then how to get to undermining that to build a society that's saner and safer, if it's possible. David, you've been here a long time. Why don't you start?
Man, I don't even know where to start. Well, first I want to say thank you, Mark, for even being a champion, using your media platform to discuss these kinds of issues and to consistently bring both local and national and even international thought leaders to the table to really begin to look at how we move forward, particularly in a city that we all love. I think there are a number of variables that we have to look at. Availability of guns, and I know Dr. Webster knows a lot about that. I mean, we definitely have to begin to ask ourselves some very critical questions in terms of where are all these guns coming from, right? So we got to begin to look at where the guns are coming from. We also have to begin to look at how do we reinvest and rebuild communities where people who are living in those communities are willing to roll up their sleeves and do some of the heavy lifting, particularly as it relates to sort of future generations of young people who are growing up in these war zones. So we always have to look at prevention, which is not often talked about, that many of these little boys that I'm working with in these neighborhoods think that this violence is a normal way to solve community disputes. And then my brother Cornell, I know, is really going to talk a lot about the families. I'm always concerned, gentlemen, with what happens to families who have experienced unbelievable atrocities. You look at brother Lucky Crosby, who lives in Sandtown.
That was his son was killed, right?
Both of his sons were killed. He's lost two sons.
The one this year.
Yeah, one this in 2016.
Right.
You know, just the overwhelming sense of grief when you not only lose one child, and I was in Cherry Hill for Fanon and Navasha's Kwanzaa celebration and met another mom who had lost two sons. And so when we look at that, those numbers, the 319, we got to think about moms and grandmoms and dads and grandfathers and children. We got to look at the total collateral damage as it relates to the violence that's plaguing our city.
Daniel?
Well, you're right in that I think that guns clearly are an important component to this, to the our problem with homicides in Baltimore. You can look at this from a sociological lens, and the clearest thing that the research literature shows is where there is concentrated social and economic disadvantage, you tend to have much higher rates of homicides and violent crime. And a natural and understandable response is, okay, we got to deal with these so-called root causes. We got to address poverty, all the injustices that hold those communities and those individuals down. And then that will help us control violence. One problem with that formula is that it's the violence itself that also holds those communities down. It leads to disinvestment in those communities. Businesses don't want to locate there. Homeowners don't want to invest there. So I think we have to address this from multiple angles. So you have to create a better sense of safety in those communities. And I think addressing, as David said, where the guns are coming from is central, but also as far as our policing strategies, our emphasis should clearly be on illegal possession of firearms, and particularly focused on what in every city tends to be a relatively small group of individuals that are the most important drivers of violence. And we know that the interconnectedness of their social networks are such that if you don't control those individuals, violence spreads just like a disease process. And I think that's exactly what we saw in 2015 and that has continued on into this year, where violence begets violence. And while there's a truism to that, and it can make us feel rather pessimistic, right? If we had a lot of homicides in 2016, that means we're going to have a lot of homicides in 2017. However, the way epidemics work is they also can go down very rapidly, and we've seen that before. And so when you have effective strategies, whether it is through violence interrupters from programs like Safe Streets, policing that is more effective in addressing gun offenders, each shooting that you prevent through those processes means you're not only just preventing one shooting, you're preventing the shooting that would have led to another one, to another one, to another one. So the process that is easy to conceive it going up also can work to go down. And I think we have to apply all our energies to make these communities safer so that you can invest in them and then address those root causes.
I'm going to pick up on your point in just a moment, come back to that. But Cornelius, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us here.
Oh, great. Great to be here. And again, thank you for the forum. And I'm appreciative to be seated with some very engaged individuals on the topic, really what we as moms, we see as a plague or an epidemic in so far as this homicide. But to sort of bring some of these thoughts together, you know, especially when we talk about law enforcement and its role or any of the tools of government and their role that to stall the violence. I think there's not enough discussion. You know, I view those and I discuss those in the context of tools against the forces of darkness, right? Someone who is selling guns on the street, you know, forces of darkness. And there are all types of police have all types of mechanisms to address those, and government has all types of tools to address those. But none of these speak to the forces of light and the power that light has. And I think there's not enough focus on energies that bring light to communities, energies that bring hope to young people, energies that heal individuals who have been victimized in so many ways. It's a multiplicity of victimization that goes into as much of this causation that results in so much homicide. But there's not enough focus on energies that bring light, the basics, you know, when a family experiences a homicide, in our experience in moms, it is generally society's notice. It is the society's notice that there is a deep problem in this family. There's some deep fissures. There's some deep injuries that have been percolating that really manifest themselves in this open wound of homicide, either by means, whether we're talking of the person who committed the crime, or whether we're talking about the individual who was killed or shot, or, you know, we're talking about deep fissures. And there's so much focus on just the immediate. We're going to, the police are going to show up, the ambulances are going to show up, and there's going to be a story here and a story there, possibly. But what has changed to bring light to a situation that yields such darkness? And I really think that we have to, you know, as a community, and as a community voice for moms, our real focus is drawing capacity to light. I think there's so little capacity for light, and I think the world, as it would be, the community as it would be, is so willing to yield its resources and its capacities in the pursuit of darkness, and so unwilling to systematically approach delivery of light. And we could talk that in terms of specifics, but just in terms of the generalities of a concept such as it.
So one of the things that's been clear to me is that over the years of living in the city, which has been my life, or my whole life just about, I left for a while, but for most of my life it's been centered in this city. And I've watched the city change dramatically in the last 60 years or so. And, you know, whether, and I was talking to my friends about this at night, whether you can look at neighborhoods like Rose and Ashland that I knew well as a kid in the east side of town when I was in the Boy Scouts at the Faith Baptist Church. And it was a tough neighborhood, but the city since then has fallen apart economically in those neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the devastation of poverty that has taken over. I mean, there might have been violence in the community. People were tough in those communities sometimes, but the murder rate wasn't astronomical. It didn't like take over the life of a community. But we can't now we can't harken back to the quote unquote good old days, whatever that meant. But mm-hmm. but we do have to think about, I mean, what are the, is this something we can do change? Or are we always barking in the wind with no change possible? Because I've seen very little change in the last 20 years, 25 years in the air in policy in terms of what we do to really really kind of blunt this, end it. You know, is it clearly Martin O'Malley's strategy of arresting our way out of it doesn't work, and neither did the strategy of ignoring it and blaming the people who live in the midst of this intense poverty. I mean, so what are the ways that we begin to really, like, say to the Pew administration, say to the Hogan administration, this is what we have to do concretely to save the lives of the people in our communities?
I think the most important thing is that we can't have a defeatist attitude.
Mm-hmm.
I really think whenever I'm talking about this in any kind of context, I feel like the first hurdle I have to get over is to convince people that this is a solvable problem. Not that we're going to eliminate homicides completely from a city like Baltimore. Of course we're not. But we can have much lower rates of homicides than we have. We have the capacity. We can invest in smart ways. I think that we have to truly make that our number one priority. And I think that it has not been our priority.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it has been, we've thought about this in rather simplistic, not particularly useful ways. I've been working in the city almost 25 years, connected to Hopkins and my work we do on violence prevention research. And for the most part, at least when I talked to somebody in law enforcement, their view had been for a long time to say, well, this is all driven by drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, the state and the federal government has given us very strong laws and some degree a mandate to use those laws to lower violence. And the research that I've done suggested that, in large part, that didn't work, that led to some of the distrust in law enforcement that is so central. If you look at this on a neighborhood basis, and some of the best research has been done in Chicago on this, where we've gotten really, really detailed data, that communities work together to lower violence. They typically have what they call collective efficacy. They can work together to solve their problems. And what is connected to that capacity? It is a close, trusting relationship with their law enforcement. So I think we need to address that issue. People become very negative and say, well, the police are the problem, and therefore, how could they be the solution? Well, it depends on how you police, and can we forge new ways in which law enforcement focuses on the needs of the communities and their safety, and not view this solely as an illegal drug problem. That there are different ways to examine this, and I think that we could apply our resources again on gun offenders and giving opportunities to young people. Because a lot of violence that is going on is really based upon economic desperation. Mm-hmm. People are doing very risky things, risking their lives for pennies, to make sure they have a roof over their head and something to eat that day. And so we have to address those things, but we have to first create this sense of safety. So we have to address these things, and rather just say, this is about a illegal drug economy, and we're going to keep beating that drug economy until we win. I don't think that's worked.
David?
Well, I definitely agree with Dr. Webster, and I think that sort of our mindset has to be that this is a solvable problem, and I don't always believe that folks move from that vantage point, that this is a problem that can be solved. But the other thing that I think is critically important is that within these neighborhoods, we also really need to begin to look at how we strengthen families. Mm-hmm. I just really believe that a more family-centered approach.
What does that mean?
A more family-centered approach that we honor families and that we're willing to invest the kind of resources in neighborhoods to build up families. Without that kind of see, a lot of times, Mark, we invest in real estate and in buildings, but we're not necessarily investing in people to make sure that those neighborhoods are safe. I mean, it's hard to have safe neighborhoods where large percentages of the people in the neighborhood live in fear, feel very disenfranchised, and also feel like they don't have equal access to opportunities that other people have in other neighborhoods. And so I think this family strengthening approach, you know, really looking at, you know, again, if I was, you know, had, you know, some semblance of any power in the city in terms of really moving some things, I would really start in a neighborhood and look at how we can elevate and move families, both economically, socially, even spiritually. That would include access to a living wage, access to equal opportunities in terms of going to be able to attend good schools, safe schools. I think all of those things play a part, but I just think that focusing on families is critically important.
So can we So are all the things necessary? I mean, you mentioned the question of how we have to change policing in Baltimore, which is something we've been wrestling with for a long time. How do we change that? Strengthening families is what you just said, which includes giving people jobs and work and a chance to build community, which you cannot do if there's no economic
infrastructure.
You can't build, right? Because that can't happen. So do we need to come up with kind of radical solutions we haven't thought about before, whether it's dealing with the police or whether it's dealing with the community itself? And what would those be?
So I can speak in terms of a clear approach. I believe that we should, as a community, invest in social emotional learning for young people. There's a whole school of research and my day job, I've been in corporate America for Fortune 250 for 18 years, and in order to get more efficiency out of and more productivity out of workers in corporate America, there's been a tremendous investment in social emotional or in employees with high levels of what they call emotional quotient, EQ. And that is to say that these individuals can take criticism, can take harsh feedback, and turn around and turn that energy into greater output. So if we have young people who we understand, my mother's a retired superintendent of schools, and she talks very much about the first time they requested her department to give third grade data from third grade students, and the understanding that there was a correlation between, suspensions and behavioral activity disruption in third graders that was used to determine, how many jails would be built sometime down the road, right? So that social emotional learning data is used by law enforcement and those energies related to the correction industry in order to identify how they will address, certain needs down the road. Why don't we take a similar approach and invest in the thinking of young people, and how they approach the world as a preventative strategy to reduce crime. It's the thinking that's wrong. It is the problem solving that's problematic. And what have we as a Baltimore community done as a collective whole to redirect the thinking of young people?
But can you redirect thinking of young people without everything else around it? So I'm saying, I mean, on the one hand, I wish we had more time today, but we did have to read these names coming up in like 10 minutes because I think it's really important for us to hear the names of the people and how old they were in our community and have all those names read on the air. But one of the things we argued about discussing the show yesterday was that I posited was that if you look at there's a connection between the future when you look at what just happened with the development of Baltimore City and the projects that are just allowed to happen in the city with subsidies here and the lack of investment in communities or lack of tying those things together. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do we have to redirect how we spend the money in this city?
Yes.
Some people have argued that should we take money out of the police department and put it in some other programs and ideas to rebuild communities and save streets and other things like that rather than just policing? I mean, that's the problem, Dan. You mentioned policing, but it's not just policing. Policing can't get us out of this long history of economic depression and oppression and racism, really, that have underlies all of this.
Oh, absolutely. So, look, I don't get me or misinterpret what I was trying to say. I don't think the solution is just a restyled policing force. I think the prevention efforts that were mentioned, I think, is very key that you start early. My research has shown that safe streets can, when applied appropriately, reduce homicides and non-fatal shootings. I think the trick is, again, is to concentrate our energies to repair these neighborhoods and bring investments. And Mark, I agree with the what I think where you're heading there, which is reapplying, how do you encourage resource investment in these communities that have the biggest problem with homicides? And I'm actually very proud of what Johns Hopkins has done with its Johns Hopkins local program, where it is trying to give priority to contractors who are based in Baltimore and serving the most high-need communities. Hopkins also has a great track record of hiring returning citizens in its medical facilities and other places. So I think anchor institutions play an important role. I think the engines of our local economy should also, be accountable and invest their resources in a similar way. Those sorts of changes take time. Mm-hmm. I think in the short term, we do need people doing this immediate work like Safe Streets to mediate these conflicts so they're less deadly, address the availability of illegal guns in these areas, and give chance for investment to take hold.
David, what were you about to say?
I mean, the only thing I would say, because I know you want to get to reading the names of the folks who lost their lives in 2016. When you look at a model like Safe Streets, I mean, it just boggles my mind why we haven't made a larger investment in models like Safe Streets. Because the reality is, somebody has to engage the quote unquote shooters, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You have to be able to navigate, coach, talk to, mm-hmm. connect these men and women to resources. So you got to have people who mm-hmm. are having a peer-to-peer relationship with the people who we know are going to do mm-hmm. the shooting. We know that we know who that small percentage is who are most likely going to be involved in these kinds of crimes. So again, we got money in Baltimore for light shows and racing car stuff downtown, but we don't have money to fund Safe Streets to the amount that it needs to be funded so it will be sustainable. But we have evidence that proves that it's effective.
Right.
So that's the thing that really boggles my mind. On one level, we have evidence, right, that this model is effective, but then Safe Streets always has to try to advocate for whether or not they're going to be refunded year mm-hmm. to year when this should be part of the city's budget.
And almost lost all their funding last year, and we almost lost Safe Streets.
A part of the money could come from the police department's budget mm-hmm. because the data says that it's effective.
So we have like 4 or 5 minutes left before the pre-recorded segment reading the names, and I was thinking about, I was imagining if we could create a conversation that said that you took Safe Streets, groups like Out for Justice, Power Inside, and turn them into community health workers
mm-hmm.
to blunt the violence mm-hmm. and maybe stop arresting people for nonviolent crimes and taking those and build a system of restorative justice within communities for people to kind of begin to change the way they do things, building the light, as you talk about, right, Cornelius? Mm-hmm. Something that brings mm-hmm. light
the
in.
The light, yeah.
Right, that brings the light in. And then starts pushing development to have to include the lives of poor people in the city that bring jobs, and jobs bring stability mm-hmm. because men and women, women, whatever your relationship is, don't stay together with their children mm-hmm. unless you have a means to keep things together, and that's an economic thing. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, seems to be...
Right. I think with Safe Streets that I've studied, we have implemented this as a series of demonstration projects in a relatively very small number of communities. It hasn't worked in every time, but generally speaking, the data are very persuasive that it reduces gun violence. We have never gotten to the point of imagining and realizing this as part of a multi-pronged strategy to reduce homicides and violence in the city, rather than just, oh, here's a federal grant that maybe mm-hmm. we can put it in a neighborhood
right.
or two.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We haven't taken hold of this mm-hmm. and said, How do we make this part of our overall strategy? And I think that's where the power really rests.
I think it is critical that, again, that this the concept that that community policing or communities' health is not just about the powers of darkness. In no other arena do we view darkness as the only solution. And so why would we in these urban communities view them so in such a monolithic way as to suggest that all the community needs in order for its health is more darkness? And that having a cohesive collective program to deliver light to this community is not part of the solution.
And I think that we have to really kind of wrestle with what those things are. Let me just read this quick thing that just came in from a caller. Listener, I apologize to our callers today, but this was a shortened segment, and because we can read these names. That Baltimore used to pay Nation of Islam members to patrol certain areas of the city, but stopped after 1.5 years. We should utilize these means because it had a positive effect on crime and drugs. George sent that in, and that's true. We talked about it in the air before, that federal pressure forced Kurt Schmoke to mm-hmm. back away from that when they actually had a huge effect.
I was at Flag House Projects when the Nation of Islam, this was back in the day when the Nation was
1993.
When the Nation came in, and it dramatically changed just the energy.
The temperature.
It changed the temperature, changed yeah. the energy. Cause the brothers in FOI came and they were well dressed, they were peaceful, and they were respectful. So it was a different kind of energy as opposed to housing authority police. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of some of these kinds of investments: Nation of Islam, Safe Streets.
So we have to take a break here because we're going to read these names. And what we will commit to here on the Mark Steiner Show is from we are going to spend these next 6 months between now and the summer really pushing the city and bringing this conversation in much longer forms on the airwaves into the community about what our alternatives are and how we get there, because we have to have a massive understanding to make mm-hmm. this change happen.
Yes.
And I want to thank for Dr. Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research. Your work is really important. Thank you, Daniel, for coming in.
Thank you.
Cornelius Wally Scott III, good to meet you, executive director of the Murdered Mothers, Sons, and Daughters Incorporated, and my good friend David Miller, who's been working on this forever. Good to thank you three so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we will read the names of those murdered in our community this year.